So. So, okay, folks decided that the current time is a good time.
Okay.
I was going to
read this first.
Oh, okay.
Remember?
No, I didn't. Okay. Go ahead.
Anyway, you may have noticed on the things over the last couple of weeks, we did mindfulness meditation, and you're here. And that was the one with the half smile and the three breaths. Okay, and then last time, we did the 7-point Bhavachana, which is concentration meditation based on body and breath. And then this coming today and this coming week, we're going to look a little bit more at mindfulness meditation, but also in combination with the concentration meditation. So, it is kind of a step-by-step process. So I wanted to read you this paragraph from this book, Reflections on a Mountain, which we've asked everybody to get. Yeah, and this one we were thinking too, Stages of Meditation. This one is by the a nun that was in a cave doing, was it 3 years? No, 12 years. 12 years of retreat. Yes, I thought you said Cave in the Snow. And these are talks that she did as she went around the country when she came out of retreat. And they're just amazing, and they're practical, and they're down to earth. And she has chapters on all the different kinds of meditation, you know, calm abiding meditation, concentration, meditation, awareness, meditation, tantra, and so forth. So I think it'll be really helpful. It'll kind of, I think, too, because we're meeting every 2 weeks, that if we have something that we can read that'll help kind of take us along and inspire us, because otherwise it, you know, just, it's easy to kind of just forget about it all. And so she says here, although it takes time, it is worthwhile to at least try to quiet the surface waves of our mind and develop some ability to focus. This is how it's always been. Now that's concentration or calm abiding meditation that she's talking about. There's another profound reason why we are supposed to develop calm abiding first and then seek to develop insight, which is the analytical meditation, which is what David's teaching. Insight meditation is intended to peel away the layers of the ego. If we begin such a practice while our egos are in a fragile state, we can end up becoming more neurotic, more disjointed, and even more psychotic. In order for us to reach a state of being calm and one-pointed, all the psychic factors have to be in balance. If they are not, we are not ready to enter deeper states of meditation. During our shamatha, calm abiding practice, the mental factors slowly begin to balance themselves. Once we reach a state of profound peace and one-pointedness, we have achieved inner balance. When we have that inner balance, the sense of ego is also in balance. Once that inner center is established, then it's time to undo the center. So basically, you know, that's why we kind of do this step-by-step process and really focus on the body and the breath and the calm abiding first. To quiet the mental factors, to quiet the emotions, you know, to get the mind some clarity and some peace and so forth. So that and one point of concentration ability. So then at that point we can go deeper in looking at the analytical meditations that David's going to be teaching. So I just wanted to start out with that little paragraph, and then, you know, he's going to talk about that a little bit more.
Sure. If I can figure it out. This. Here we go. So, all of Buddhist practice is about moving from living superficially only to living superficially and at depth, at the core. Sometimes people think that spiritual practice, especially Asian spiritual practice, is about going from the superficial, the mundane, the ordinary, to transcending everything, which might be like getting to the core. As a matter of fact, just before I got sick, I read into student at the university, and we were talking about something. He said, well, you're a Buddhist, why don't you just transcend all that stuff? And I said, no, it's not about transcending everything. It's about becoming fuller. It's not about leaving something behind and going someplace else. But becoming whole. And to be whole is to be both at the surface and at the depth, not at one place or the other. So for most of us, I mean, in this society, probably is not any different than any other, we kind of live superficially. I mean, in ancient days, I think people did superficially because they were so busy trying to stay alive, they didn't have any choice. excuse me. But I think that our superficial existence, for most of us at some point, becomes something we recognize is not enough. It's not so much like it's bad. Well, for some people, maybe it's bad. But mostly, I think it's a matter of it's not enough. For me, that was always the issue. I mean, sometimes it was pretty bad. But what drew me to spiritual practice, whatever that was, and kind of evolved over my life, was wanting to be more and feeling like I was less. So how can I be more, which is whole? So a whole person, a complete person, is a Buddha. That's it. I mean, I think some people think a Buddha is like some sort of God or something like that. There was a time where actually when reporters would talk about the Dalai Lama, you know, in the 1950s before the diaspora, but when they knew about him, they say he's a living Buddha. That's okay. Sometimes they say he's a living God. That's not really where it's at. But anyhow, the idea is that a complete person or a perfect person is a Buddha, and everybody has the potential to be that. Every being that's alive has the potential to be a Buddha. It's just, how do you get from where you are to there? So meditation is the prime way of getting from wherever you're starting from to that there. It's not really a matter of leaving something behind. I mean, it sort of is, because there are some things to leave behind, like addictions, toxic attitudes, mean-mindedness, you know. Cupcakes? No. Cupcakes are not left behind. They're definitely part of the path to enlightenment. Totally. So, yeah, and so getting from the here to the there is actually called the path to enlightenment. Enlightenment is the state of a Buddha, which is like sometimes called waking up. In fact, in Tibetan, the word for Buddha is Sangye, and Tibetan's a very interesting language because the technical Buddhist language of Tibet was created artificially in the 8th century when the Tibetans began to adopt Buddhism. So it was very kind of concrete. And so, for example, the word Buddha, Sangye, which means then to increase waking up. So a Buddha is the person who has increased waking up to absolute maximum. So he's fully awake, which is then a complete person is a person that's totally awake, or a perfect person is a person that's totally awake. So that's what the goal is. And so then the question, again, is the path. And it's not really leaving the superficial behind and only getting into some sort of refined state, but it's a matter of sort of expanding to include everything. So, for example, one of the things that we've noticed about our own teachers, certainly in the Tibetan tradition, but I'd say in all the Buddhist traditions that I'm familiar with, is that they all have definite personalities. They're really distinct persons. It's not like in this process of evolving and growing, they've somehow become more or less the same in some way, but they're really distinct, you know, and they have completely different senses of humor and different ways of teaching and just different everything, and yet they're all very, very refined and very extraordinary. So in becoming more, they haven't become less unique. They've somehow in some weird way, become even more unique by becoming more of a person, which I think kind of flies in the face of what we might think about this process. So when we talk about meditation as the route to get from the superficial to the deep, there are kind of three categories of practice. And this is not a traditional way of talking about these things, but to kind of segue on what Kay opened up. There's a group of practices that might be called mindfulness, a group that could be called one-pointedness or settling or focusing. And there's a group that could be called analytical or insight. So there's no good English terms, really, for what the Buddhists originally tried to get at. So sometimes I use a couple different words. So mindfulness, which is sort of a basic practice of noticing what's going on, because mostly we go through our time not noticing what the heck we're really doing. I mean, the classic to me is driving a car while you're talking on a cell phone. I mean, it's very hard to be actually totally mindful while you're driving a car, but to be talking on a cell phone at the same time makes it really hard to actually be where you are. Or walking down the street while you're talking on a cell phone. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with talking on a cell phone, or even walking down the street talking on a cell phone. But to me, why would you want to not be where you are? And if you're kind of walking down the street talking on a cell phone, you aren't where you are. You're someplace else. So mindfulness is like noticing what you're actually doing. And that's all, just noticing what's going on. What do you hear? What do you see? What do you smell? What do you touch? What's your intention? What's going on in your mind? How does your body feel? And it's a good practice for people just to sort of like, you know, get out of narrow focus into the kind of full experience. It also can keep you out of trouble in interesting ways, the Buddhists say. So that's sort of one category of thing, and Kay has talked about that a little bit. And then another category of practice, which is maybe a little bit more sophisticated or advanced than that, when you get used to the idea of becoming self-conscious. I mean, most of us are already self-conscious, so that's not really an issue. But for some people it is, like a lot of teenagers that I run into, for example. So then a next level is, or a next category, I wouldn't say level, a next category is focusing meditation. And that's mostly what I think people think of when they think about meditation, which is taking all of the stuff that's flying around in our minds and our attention zooming all over the place and being distracted here or there in the other place. Even if you're mindful, practicing mindfulness, you know, when there's sounds, you're noticing the sounds. When there's certain feelings, then you're noticing the feelings. So your attention is moving all around. Focusing meditation is constantly coming back to one thing. So if you pick an object of meditation, whether it's a rock, we'll mention that, or an image, or your own breath, or your own awareness, your mind will kind of, your attention will kind of go off, and you just constantly bring it back. It'll go off, and you bring it back. Go off, and you bring it back. You start practicing with this, and it could also be called concentration, because basically what you're doing is bringing your focus together on one something and holding it there for as long as you can. And of course, it'll ooze away when you bring it back. You'll ooze away and you bring it back. So it's a very difficult practice, actually, to do. But when you can do it, what happens is your mind becomes really peaceful and you begin to experience a kind of inner peacefulness. So a lot of people think that's what meditation is. If you go to a Zen center, you find a lot of people sitting there, for example, in the Soto Zen tradition, they'll be sitting there watching their breath, and their mind will wander off, and they'll come back to watching their breath. Their mind will wander off, and they'll come back. And they get real peaceful from doing that. Yes? Right. Who has the Zen tradition, Soto Zen tradition?
And I think I'm paraphrasing her correctly, but it's not for an hour. She said that Jill Kenneth, who was head of Shasta, I think redirected, but discouraged focusing on the breath or choosing any focal point because it's doing two things at once instead of one thing.
Mm.
Now, by that, what does she mean two things at once? Or is this, if you're worrying about, if you're sitting facing the wall and so does Dan, if you're telling yourself, I have to follow my breath, you're distracting yourself even more fully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, what she's saying is there's an old Soto Zen tradition that goes back to Dogen, which is, I think it's called Shikan Tanza. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Anyhow, it means just sitting. Don't do anything but just sit. So if you're thinking about sitting, then you're doing two things. You're sitting and you're thinking about it. And so it's the same kind of thing. So she was reinforcing that tradition, which is great if you can do it. But I don't know many people are going to be able to do that. And the potential of just sitting, if you're not advanced enough to actually just do that, is that you're not doing anything. And if you're not doing anything, then you're not accomplishing anything either. I mean, there is a Zen notion that you're not supposed to accomplish anything. Again, that requires some kind of complicated contextualization, so I want to set it aside. But our own tradition, our own teacher, one of our teachers, Tara Tulku, kind of ran into that when he visited San Francisco Zen Center, where Kay and I both went off and on different times, although when he visited, when he said this particular thing, we weren't living there. But I don't know what they're doing. Now, this is really interesting. I mean, this is a great master in the Tibetan tradition. When he died, he was one of the two people who was in line to be head of the whole tradition. The Dalai Lama is not actually the head of their tradition. They have somebody else, and it's like a meritocracy to achieve this position. So he was going to be the next one. So he really knew what his thing was. He knew what he was talking about. So he said, I don't know what these people are doing at Zen Center.
Well, he'd ask them, what are you doing?
He would ask me.
What are you doing? What are you, what is your, I think Aaron, the types of meditation they were doing, he would also say, was very, very advanced. So he did recognize some steps, but it's like, there's a lot of steps that build up to that. And one of the things that is really good about using the breath, initially, it's like the first thing to kind of focus on, is in doing that, it automatically pulls the wind into the central channel and starts to settle the mind, whereas then focusing on the whole body if you can while you're doing the breath, and you're actually trying not to think about it. You're just trying to actually focus in and watch and just keep bringing your attention back, but not actually being thinking about it.
So the point that Kay is making that I eventually would have gotten to was there are advanced practices and then there's the stuff that most of us can do. And so there's a danger in not seeing that there's a stepwise progression. And if you're studying algebra, you don't expect to go to the Advanced Institute of, Princeton Advanced Institute and understand geophysics or whatever it is that's going on there, if you know what I'm saying. So what Kenneth Roshi was talking about, which sounds incredibly simple, is actually unbelievably advanced. And a lot of Zen is like that. And so what Tara Tulku was saying is, what you guys are talking about is an incredibly advanced practice, but it's not what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
It builds on so, or you can make a choice to say, I'm not going to progress. Or is it just sort of a, integral thing that you, because you are, that you progress like in everything else.
I would actually oddly say it's both. I mean, you do keep progressing because you gain understanding and depth and capacity and facility. So you do keep growing and changing that way. And you could say that's enough, I'll stop there. But my own experience is that the natural process is such that it won't stop. Even if you kind of like think, oh yeah, this is nice, you know, I can sit here for 40 minutes and it's pretty peaceful. I don't really need to do anything else. And 40 minutes is a Zen sitting session, the way we trained. So, well, 40 minutes is, that was nice, I don't really need to do anything else, and that's satisfactory for me, and I'll go about my daily business. Except, I think what tends to happen is you get this niggling something, and you're like, that's really nice, I think I want to sit again and do some more of that. It's not like it's addictive, that's not what I'm saying. It's much more like when you start living more in the core of yourself, it's so satisfactory that you don't want less of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or if you can get so deep into yourself, you just start finding yourself, I think, falling deeper into yourself, that it is very natural in that respect. And it's not like, I don't know how you could, I mean, you could make a decision to not do anymore. And I think we've met people who've done that. You know, it's like, I don't want to do this anymore because it's, I don't want to devote more time to this because it's taking me away from my family or something like that. But, I mean, in terms of the what it is, it has a satisfactoriness that's compelling.
We have practices that we both do, but we don't do it together anymore.
Yeah, so
more separate now.
So it is sort of a singular thing, then, right?
Well, the way Kay and I practice now is really different, actually. We went through.
Yeah, and we've kind of gone off on, it's the same foundation, but we've kind of gone off on focusing on different aspects of it. I mean, that's the way I do it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there were times when we practiced together, and we basically just did the same thing. For example, we had a really long retreat that we did in India. And, you know, we sat down together and we recited things together out loud and we meditated in the same way out loud and we accumulated the same number of mantras. That's the way these retreats go. So we were basically doing the same thing, and it was very strong because our energies and our intentions supported each other. But then there was also a time after that where, you know, my personality is really different than hers, and so my inclination was to move in a different direction and cultivate something else using that as a foundation. No. No, not at all.
I think there's a group energy, you know, like when we used to meditate at Zen Center, we were supposed to spend a substantial amount of time in the Zen community, and that we were meditating with the community. I think that it does, that it is helpful. To a certain degree, because it's really kind of and I don't know why exactly, except if we are interconnectedness and that we all have the same intention, you know, we're all working on this together, and because of that, yeah.
Well,
and it felt safe. There was a place, like they say, with the calm abiding meditation, that's really important to have a place where you feel it's quiet and calm, and so you feel safe, too, the practice, that because you're going into deep and you want to be quiet and you're,
I don't think you remember. We asked this question to Sangye, who was a young monk that we knew when we were staying at guest house at the Dalai Lama's monastery, where we did this really long retreat. Why do you guys all meditate together? Because they would come together in the meditation hall several times. And so I asked him, I said, so why do you guys meditate together? And he said, well, a broom with one bristle won't clean very much. I thought, God, that was great. I mean, that was just fantastic, you know. Vroom with one bristle won't clean very much. Okay, now I understand why it's good to practice together.
But they also, like, when they have the occasion, which is very rare, unfortunately, in the monastery, they would, you know, set aside a special room, and one person would get to go in and do their intensive practice and have food brought to them and the whole thing, so that they could just totally focus on that and not have to interact with people and everything else. So there is a benefit also to doing it on your own without distraction and without that, too. So it's some of both.
Yeah.
You need some of both.
Does that? You have this quizzical look.
In terms of, you know, the growth pattern, if you don't mind me interrupting.
I know.
Too, it's like what we both found is that with our practices, that there's some, we have an inner teacher, too. So when you actually kind of hook in to the practice that you're doing, it actually turns around and teaches you that. So you start growing in the way, too, this inner, the interaction with this being part of yourself that starts teaching you. And that you have to respect and honor too. And so sometimes it might tell you, you know, for your health and well-being, you know, you lay down this part of the practice for a while, you focus on something else, or you need to rest, or, you know, whatever it is that you need. So you have to, you know, kind of learn how to balance that and respect it too, so that, you know, you don't just, you know, just follow this rigid.
It's fine with me.
Make this really truly a part of your life day to day? I mean, how, I mean, when you connected into it, how long did it take before it was just a given? Wasn't it infinite? Like, oh God, I gotta make time for that. I mean, when it just became, how long did it take?
You know, that's gonna be different for everybody, but I can answer the question for me. Let me answer the question for me. Yes, I am very intellectual, but when I finish these kind of three different approaches, there is a place for the intellectual in those three approaches, and so I'll get to that too. But I may be very intellectual, but I'm also very comfortable with recognizing that I can't stand my own intellect a lot of the time and just would like to set it aside. So I need the opportunity to do that, and meditation gives me that. But to answer the main question that you were asking, the Tibetan teacher who most fully drew me into the practice of Buddhism, and I've had other teachers in other traditions at other times. So, but the long-running practice in my life, I mean, you know, like maybe, you know, 3 years with one teacher and 7 years with another teacher, but the practice that started in, I guess maybe 1987, has continued up to now. So that's the longest-running practice. So Kay and I took training in this particular practice in 1987. We did a month-long retreat with this teacher. But it didn't exactly stick fully. We ended up doing four different retreats with him over a period of, I don't know, 4 years. And you know, so it would be kind of off and on, off and on, off and on for me, because it's a very complicated practice. I had to find 90 minutes to 2 hours to do this. And I was like, I mean, how do you do that, you know, when you have an intensive life in the world? So I couldn't, and then he died. And it was sort of like, ugh, I'm, you know, now what? A year after that, we went to India, and his guidance, Kay visited with him when he died, just before he died. His guidance was, go see the Dalai Lama and find out what to do next. It took a year, we got back. We went to see him, and he said, go do a long retreat. Actually, it's just a go do a retreat. It would have been a month. It turned out to be a very long retreat. And it turned out that we spent 7 months at his monastery. Well, that did it. That did it, because that level of practice really changed me. It hooked me in a different way.
That was like having the same day all day.
Yes, it was.
I mean,
Yes, it was. But that was me. I'm not saying that that's the way it is for everybody. I can only speak for myself in this respect. You know.
They do recommend that you do, like, that it's good to do a familiar, they call it familiarization retreat, which is like, can you stay with the same like 2 or 3 weeks, where you can actually just sit and practice. I mean, you don't have to be do it. I mean, we did, I think it was 3 sessions and then 1 session of teaching. It wasn't like just nonstop all day long.
But when you say to these teachers, this is like, okay, I'm going to take ballet. This is like, I find a ballet teacher that I like. And in order for me to become a good dancer, I have to take lessons, these ballet lessons. And if you don't take ballet lessons, then you're not going to make more ballet.
Right.
So are you saying that you're not really going to become proficient at getting up the medicine and learn all the stuff that you don't find as a teacher?
We have to.
Yeah, but I'm, you know, for spiritual things. But
I think that the answer to the question that you're asking is that you start where you start, and things take you where they take you. Okay, in the Tibetan tradition. So now I'm gonna answer your question by looping back to where I was gonna go, which was these 3 general categories of practice. We talked about concentration, and then your question came up, and we talked about mindfulness. The third, which is insight or analytic meditation. The Buddhists also say that you have to listen to the teachings or read about them, and then think about them, and then contemplate them or do an analytic meditation or just sort of sit and think about these things without anything else happening. If you do that, which is like what we would call in the West study, if you study enough, then what happens is you begin to have a thirst for the experience that's being pointed to in what you're studying. So what the intellectual thing does is it reorients you and it creates that thirst. And what the thirst will do is it will attract somebody who will teach you what you need to know. And if the thirst is serious enough, then that will begin to enter your life. So it's not like you have to go off someplace and do a retreat. It's more like the thirst will bring a teacher, rather than a spiritual friend like us, will bring an actual teacher, guru type of person into your life, and they will transmit to you the practice that you need, and the enthusiasm will be there to take it up. And even if it's 10 minutes a day, then it's 10 minutes a day. And after a while, 10 minutes a day will feel so good that it will turn into 15 minutes a day. And then it'll be 2 15-minute sessions a day, or whatever. You know, and it kind of grows in a very natural way. But it can start with conceptuality. I mean, this is, you know, the Zen tradition would not probably say this, but the Tibetan tradition and most other Buddhist traditions definitely do say this. I mean, there's some unique things about the Zen tradition that we can get into, where they talk about, you know, not wanting to be intellectual, and this has to do with history and culture and all this kind of thing. But most Buddhist traditions start with you listen to the teachings and gain some understanding, and then based upon the understanding that you begin to gain, you kind of look at what's going on around you and you begin seeing it intellectually in a different way. So this is very good for Americans because we're so highly educated. You know, so you start seeing things in a little bit different way and you say, oh, okay, I hadn't really looked at it that way. That makes sense. Well, okay, so I'm going to stop doing that thing over there that I used to do, and I want to do these other things that I never used to do, because I can see why that's a nice thing to do, whether it's meditation or just, you know, making a decision to make one person happy a day or something like that, you know. And I went through that. Like, I once made a vow that I was going to make one person happier a day, and my big thing was going through the checkout line, and whether you know, like grocery stores or things like that. And I would chat up the cashier, you know, and I'd find something funny to say or whatever that would, like, you know, it's like, otherwise it's like they're just kind of like ka-ching, 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 and it's like, there's another person. And it's kind of like...
Or you can see the person behind you.
That would be a good thing, but, yeah. All kinds of possibilities.
Yeah, that happens to
me. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, left and, you know... He was looking at my stuff, and he looked at me, and looked at my stuff, and then he's an older man. And a couple of years ago, this happened at
Wow.
They got the car right away, and then, I mean, he's, you know, some leaves, and it was like, I don't know, I had $50 worth of stuff that he bought. And one stage, he goes, an older man, someone takes my picture.
Wow.
And he goes, in fact, you get $3.
I get $3 extra. It is harder to do it in the checkout line at Walmart than in Safeway.
I
think a lot of them are actually quite happy to be working, and so they're not complaining. So back to your question. So it's okay. So I mean, those are all great examples. Those are exactly the, you know, yeah, but you were kind of giving off, right? So, but the main thing is that starting off by studying, it really does develop this thirst, and then the other stuff kind of follows, you know. So one of the things that's occurred to us is, depending upon sort of the life of whatever happens with whoever shows up in this event that is doing whatever it's doing, is that, I mean, we do know lamas, you know. So, I mean, if the time comes that there's a certain level of practice that people want that we don't feel it's appropriate for us to pass forward, you know, they're available. I mean, technically, I mean, this is odd to say, but technically, based upon the way we've been trained, we could give you everything, technically. Realistically, because we know who we are and what our limits are, we're not that stupid as to think we could do that. But there's, you know, there's a lot that we can help you get oriented toward. What? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, you don't know, too, you know, I mean, and within our tradition, we believe that, you know, there's a many eons of past lives and so forth. So you don't know what people have come in to in terms of practice. And so that's where it gets tricky for us, too, because there might be things that we'll be, you know, showing you that are just kind of, you know, the first steps, initial steps. And some, I think all of you have had some kind of experience already, so it's not, you know, so we don't know quite where to go with that, but the some of you may be ready really quickly, you know, like shoot through, you know, what we're saying and have deep one point of concentration and, you know, understand the analytical part and say, hey, you know, I want to, you know, go on, I want to take some topic initiation or something on the fast track, basically, or something like that. And that could happen too. I mean, we've each had our own experience in regards to that too. And for, you know, one teacher made me wait for a long time. One teacher didn't make me, you know, like basically made me wait a couple hours instead of 5 years. And I mean, that's
true.
Arrogant, but it's true. But on the other hand, I've been doing some Zen practice, you know, pretty intensely before that for about 9 months. So, I, strangely enough, I was doing early steps in a way of the concentration and mindfulness meditation because we had to just train it. So, there's just, I don't know quite exactly what I'm trying to say here, but yeah, so we don't know how fast you guys will progress through this stuff, how much, what you want, but as long as we can, you know, be here to answer questions, try and help you along that way, and try and bring in people if it comes to that, you know, that would be where you want to take another step. And also we have the teaching coming in, you know, you asked me too, we have lots of potential for.
And that's what I was talking about, whether we go there or he comes here. Yakima. Yes, apparently. So, anyhow, so from my own point of view, you know, as long as we are getting together, then we're broom.
That's fine.
Especially right after Halloween, right?
So,
7:35.
Oh, 7:35 already?
Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to turn this thing off.
Actually, I want to show you the...